Here's Rick Amato.
This is T.J. O'Hara going in for Rick Amato tonight. I am the author of three best-selling books, The Left Isn't Right, The Right Is Wrong, and The National Platform of Common Sense. We'll chat about those a little bit more later. If you don't have a copy, you can go to my website, thecommonsensezar.net, and click on the store, and it gives you links to Amazon.com, Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, every place fine books are sold. Easy to pick up a copy. I used to write a regular column for the communities of the Washington Times. And if you go to thecommunities.washingtontimes.com, they have been polite enough to archive those. I've been on a bit of a hiatus for about 2 months, for those of you who have been kind enough to ask. But there may be a time in the near future when I'm back live, writing on that on a more regular basis, or at least being reported on in a more regular basis. We're going to talk about presidential politics and party politics in general. This is a critical time, and I think we need to stay up on what's happening. Now, you know, the national debt passed $15 trillion this week, and yet many of us seem to be more focused on some semblance of political sensationalism than we are on the more pressing issues of the economic collapse of this country. And many of those politicians who purport to address the issue of economics spend more time fixing the blame than they do fixing the problem. And this behavior, in my opinion, has to stop. Now, the 2012 election is too important to entrust to the initials after a name, because far too often D stands for dumb and R stands for ridiculous. Now, people have asked me in the past, why did you write the interesting flip book where you read one direction, it's the Democratic National Platform, you read the opposite direction, it's the Republican National Platform, in a tongue-in-cheek satirical style, but it's the actual text followed by some satire. And that book, The Left Isn't Right and The Right Is Wrong, was really driven by the fact that I had done a soft survey of over 100 people, far left, far right, everything in between. And I asked them a series of questions, and there were only two germane points that were almost identical across the board. They were all passionate about their political beliefs. Didn't matter if they were on the left or the right or somewhere in between. Passionate about their beliefs. Then I ask the simple question, have you ever read the national platform of either of the two major parties? Almost 50% of the people didn't even know there was a national platform, and I embarrassingly had to explain that every presidential election year, the major parties put together in black and white, in effect, what could be a report card, what they truly believe and what they intend to do if their candidate wins. And it was phenomenal that almost half the people didn't even know that existed. But what was even worse, 100% of the people that I surveyed had never read either platform. Now, had they read one and liked it, I could see a basis for their passionate belief to say, yes, we support that. That's totally in alignment with my personal beliefs. Or had they read it and thoroughly disliked it and defaulted to the other party, just assuming it would be different, I could accept that too. But that wasn't the case. They hadn't read either. So we had wildly passionate beliefs on one hand and absolutely no factual basis for it on the other. And that creates a dilemma. And what we need to do, the key to the 2012 election, is to create a more informed electorate. My belief is that voters who are better informed will ultimately make better selections among their candidates, and they'll drive better party politics. And when we come back, more truth about party politics in America. This is T.J. O'Hara going in for Rick Amato tonight. And when we left off, we were talking about the importance of an informed electorate, because voters who are better informed pick better candidates. This was emphasized for me this week. I happened to catch an interview of a student who was of voting age. And the question was asked who Snooki was from Jersey Shores, and he immediately was able to talk about that particular character. Then they asked him who Mitt Romney was. Absolute dead silence. Had no idea. This is a person of voting age who has the ability to influence decisions. It's a voting block that parties are going after. You know, I'm not going to pick on that particular student. Many of us don't do our homework when it comes to candidates and issues. You know, we seem to have gotten into a quandary where we accept mediocrity, or even worse from our elected officials. Many of us are resigned to accept the status quo. And I feel we don't ask enough questions, and I'm going to make that my personal challenge from this point forward to push the envelope on the questions so we get the answers we deserve so we can make better decisions. How many times have you received a politically inflammatory email? Sounds just unbelievable when you read the text. You think that can't possibly be happening in America and so forth. Only to find out when somebody takes the time to corroborate it that it's not accurate at all. And this happens. I get emails from the left and from the right. I get solicitations from the left and the right. Today I got one from Jill Biden asking me to sign a birthday card for Vice President Joe Biden. And I do that. I do that just for kicks. I think anybody who runs for public office deserves our respect, so I sent him a little birthday greeting. But, of course, at the end of that greeting, I was asked for a donation. It doesn't matter anymore from an integrity standpoint how politics are viewed. It's all become about power and money, and part of that's because we don't ask enough questions. I mean, what happens when you do, quote-unquote, quantitative easing? Now, first of all, why not ask the question, why don't we just call it printing money? Because that's what quantitative easing is, except we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars flooding the market. Now, let me put that in perspective. A dollar bill isn't based on the silver standard anymore. It isn't based on gold. It isn't based on anything else other than our imagination. I hate to be the one to break that to you, but the reality is it's a piece of paper that serves as a guarantee that it has what we term a dollar's worth of value. Now, think about that. When we can just print that for no basis, unquestionably over time, when we flood the market with unbased paper, we're going to drive something called inflation. And we had a promise by the current president that there'd be no new taxes on the middle class or even on the poor. Now, they leave the poor out because there aren't enough poor to influence the votes, and they don't have enough money to donate when it's the vice president's birthday. So they concentrate on the middle class now. And in that context, you start thinking about it, and you say, well, if we have inflation and the price of a loaf of bread goes up a dollar, or milk goes up a dollar, or gas goes up $2, if we're not going to have a tax that impacts the middle class as well as the poor, then how do we deal with that? Because quite frankly, inflation is nothing more than a government-generated cost of living increase. So that loaf of bread doesn't know that the additional dollar that's being charged isn't really based on a tax. It is based on government action. But we don't ask questions about that. I like to refer to that as an ignorance tax. We don't ask the questions. We'd prefer to remain ignorant and pretend that that's not the basis for that cost. Now, when a politician promises something, we don't ask some simple questions, and we should. We should ask, why do you want to do that? We should ask, when are you going to do that? And the most important question, how? Now, if you follow the Republican debates, one of my favorites, we have a couple of candidates in the debates who will fit in to any subject matter. It doesn't matter if you're talking about Afghanistan or whatever, but the quote usually comes out, when I am elected, the first day I am elected, I will repeal Obamacare. Now, that's a frightening thought, because this is a person who is at some point in time, if they are elected, going to take the oath of office, which says, I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Well, if you're going to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, I would suggest a really good starting point would be to have read it. Because under Article 2, which dictates what the president can and cannot do, and their very limited powers, quite frankly, beyond influence, you have no ability to repeal anything. But we never ask that question. How are you going to repeal it, since the Constitution precludes you from doing that? That would be a good starting point. So let's start learning to ask more questions. The problem is when we don't, the parties exploit it. It's all about power, and it's all about money, and the money that can buy the power. So let's begin to uncover the game of party politics tonight. Now, I call it a game of party politics because they treat it as a game. Think of the terminology they use. Opponents. Well, my opponent said this, and my opponent said that, and my plan is better than my opponent's. Well, that suggests it's some sort of competition. And what it really is, when you're running for president of the United States, you're actually applying for a job. It's no different than the private sector. You're applying for a job. Now, how many times have you applied for the job where you felt that it was some sort of intense competition where you had to denigrate the abilities of the other person rather than provide a basis for the employer to understand why you were the best choice? You know, that's substance over form when you provide solutions that identify you or experience that identify you as the superior candidate. Can you imagine in the private sector if you were hiring somebody and you happened to bring all the candidates into the room or you stepped out into the hallway where they were waiting to be interviewed and they were arguing about each other and calling themselves names and denigrating each other's policies and beliefs? It's ridiculous. The other thing is, you know it's a game because what do they always talk about? Winning. Well, we're going to win the House. We're going to win the Senate. We're going to win the presidency. Really? Well, it's not a game to me, and it shouldn't be to you either. It's about time that America woke up to party politics. And basically, if you haven't seen Network News, the movie from back, I believe it's 1986, you ought to go back and see that for two reasons. That's the famous newscaster who told everybody they should get mad and tell everybody, lean out their windows and say,
"I'm not going to take this anymore."
That's the quote. Thank you. Todd, our technician, is really going to bat for me tonight. We should be mad because what's going on is insulting to us. This isn't a game. This is the United States of America. This is a country that within about 46 years became the largest economy in the world. And I believe the 46 years is correct. Think about that. From its inception, it only took 46 years to become the biggest economy in the world. And for 200 years, it's been a dominant power. And yet, we want prolific change. We want to sacrifice freedoms because it's inconvenient. It takes power away from the parties. And I'm talking both parties. And the reason they won't tell you this is because they're playing the same game. It's a little bit like checkers. One time, red wins, one time black wins. Then the next time, maybe red wins twice and black wins three times, then red wins again, black wins again. Over the course of history, they all win their fair share. And that's really okay with them. They'd like to win every game. They know it's not going to happen. They're pretty evenly matched. But it's just a game. What would happen if we came up and said, really nice board you got there, and we wiped off all the checkers, and we dumped a bunch of funny-looking pieces down and said, we're going to play chess. Wow, talk about shock and awe. Can you imagine how they would respond to that? The whole game is based on an interesting diagram. I like to call it the Liberty Bell curve. If you drew a picture of a standard bell curve, maybe flatten it out a little bit so it looks like a Liberty Bell up at the top, put a real big square in the middle. If you got a piece of paper and a pen, do this. It's a fun exercise. Build a big square in the middle. Then put smaller squares to the immediate left and immediate right, and still smaller squares to the left and right of those middle squares at this point, those two mid-tier squares. And so you've got five squares, big one in the middle, somewhat smaller to each side of it, and smaller yet to the extremes. And draw a little standard curve. The far left and the far right, somewhat appropriately, if you want to be politically correct, put the Democrat base on the left and the Republican base on the right. These are the fundamentally committed people. These are the people who have subjected themselves to cognitive dissonance. They will not listen to fact. They are so committed to the party, whether they actually know what the party says, because if you interview most of them, they haven't read the party platform either. So it's their perception of what the party stands for. But they are so fundamentally committed that they aren't willing to entertain a rational discussion or explore a factual basis for decisions. They just default to an answer because they've been told to do that. That next tier in, as you move towards the big square in the middle, I like to call relatively committed from a behavioral standpoint. These are the people who, for whatever reason, if you ask them, are you a Democrat or are you a Republican, they will identify themselves as one or the other, but they don't strictly vote on party lines. There may be a single issue that they feel so adamant about that if their party of preference candidate doesn't support that in the way that they feel is consistent with their personal beliefs, they will look for a different candidate. They may cross over to the other party. They may not vote. They may vote for an independent or someone else. But they're relatively committed. So they will default to the party line when they either don't have sufficient information to make a decision or there isn't anything so offensive by the candidate being run by the party of their choice that would push them away. Now you've got this middle group, and let's call that the uncommitted, the big square in the middle. Now, they're not uncommitted from a belief standpoint. They are as committed to their beliefs as anyone in any of the other squares, but they don't conform to party lines. They examine the facts. They apply those facts based on their personal experiences and the beliefs that those experiences drive. And then they make their decisions based on those facts. Sometimes they vote for Republicans. Sometimes they vote for Democrats. They may throw a Libertarian in there every now and then, or even a Green Party member. It just depends on the issue. They generally take a little more time actually paying attention to the facts. Now, the reason they become really important, because you see this during the primary. You have the candidates who pander to the fundamentally committed. Because they have to. Those are the people that are going to vote en masse during the primaries. Now, here's the problem. You can't get elected when you're in an extreme position. Because you can't get elected without that uncommitted group, the independent group in the middle. You need a certain amount, a certain percentage of that vote. So what happens after the primaries and the parties vet their candidate of choice for the presidency, that candidate starts drifting back towards the center because they have to. Now, here's a question for you. Why not ask those candidates, whomever they happen to be for the Republican and the Democratic Party, why not ask them a simple question? Were you misrepresenting your position during the primaries, or are you misrepresenting it now? Because it can't be both ways. Think about it. They can't change positions unless they are simply doing it for political reasons. And they're doing it for political reasons because they have to buy the mind share of the people in the middle. And the fundamentally committed serve another purpose. They write the bigger checks. These are the George Soroses on the left and the Koch brothers on the right. They write the big checks. They go to the $35,800 a plate dinners. The relatively committed write much smaller checks, but a lot more of them. So they're important too. And all that money is kind of piled on a table and used to try and buy votes from the independent. Part of it's used to solidify the base. The vast majority is used to try and buy that middle share. And when we come back, more truth about party politics in America. This is T.J. O'Hara filling in for Rick Amato tonight, and I hope some of you are joining me on Twitter as well. We've got tweets going out that are giving you some good questions to ask of presidential candidates, some what-if questions. What if certain things happen? What if a candidate existed who did such and such? Follow me on Twitter tonight. I think you'll have some fun with those questions, and feel free to tweet me back. Let me know how you feel about them. Now, we were getting into the money issue. Let's explore money. There's something really interesting among presidential candidates. 2008 and 2012 election as well, President Obama, for example, has said he will accept no PAC money. Now, for those of you who don't know the significance of that, that's a way of suggesting that I'm going to insulate myself from the influence of union money, business money, and money from other organizations. Because unions and businesses and other types of organizations cannot contribute directly to a political campaign. They can contribute to a PAC. So by saying I will not accept money from a PAC, it sounds like someone is standing above others who are willing to accept that type of infusion of money, and perhaps they're more insulated from the influence. Here's the inside scoop on that. It's easy to figure out, really, when you follow the money. Individuals are allowed to give $2,500 to a federal candidate in a primary and another $2,500 in a general election. So that's $5,000 total. So, as they used to say on the TV show, riddle me this, Batman. How is it that you can charge $35,800 per plate for a campaign dinner? Well, let me tell you how that works. $2,500 gets set aside for the candidate for the primary, another $25 for the general. So that covers $5,000 of it. And it gets designated as that $5,000 goes there. Well, that leaves $30,800. That goes to a different campaign committee. For example, the DNC or the RNC. And they can pretty much spend that any way they want. So while it doesn't go directly to the president in the example that I use, but other candidates who have done that, and it happens on both sides, they all have these massively expensive dinners for their high rollers. And that money goes to a DNC or an RNC or something similar. And those organizations can spend money running ads and printing billboards and so forth for the candidate. It's not coming out of the candidate's committee. You know, does the term money laundering mean anything to anybody? It goes on all the time. Now, what happens to your $3 donation? You ever wonder that? If you make a $3 donation on your 1040 form, on your taxes, do you know that presidential candidates don't accept that money that's being placed in reserve? I haven't tracked it down. I don't know where it goes, but it's going somewhere, and it can't be going to the candidates because it's a paltry sum of money. And they can raise way more than that, and there are handcuffs associated with it, so they don't accept it, and they instead try and raise, for example, the president has, his committee has stated a goal of $1 billion. They're the party of the poor, by the way, poor in the middle class. Now, the Republicans, the party of the rich, generally speaking, raise half as much. I don't know if they're just ineffective at soliciting or they really aren't the party of the rich, but they'll raise, if history proves out, they will raise about $500 million. Now, let's put that in perspective. That means these parties, these two parties alone, are going to spend $1.5 billion. That's billion with a B on a job that pays $400,000. And you wonder why we have economic problems in Washington. Now, how is that money spent? How are they going to go through $1.5 billion? Well, they're going to run hundreds of millions of dollars of ads, most of which are going to be negative. And they're going to send a lot of unsolicited campaign literature. And if you think it's bad now, wait till you get to the last 2 months of the general election, where you're going to get mailers every night, whether you want them or not. And generally speaking, they're going to be demeaning to the opposing candidates. They're not going to concentrate so much on why one person is better than the other. It's not going to be like, here's my resume, here's my experience, here are my thoughts. No, it's going to be why the other person shouldn't get the job. They're also going to at least kill one or two forests, printing billboards, bumper stickers, and yard signs. And all those things are going to do is despoil the landscape. When you drive down your street and you see yard sign after yard sign after yard sign, or billboard here, billboard there, bumper stickers on cars, think about it. For all those who like to talk about the environment and our green presidencies and so forth, they have to kill a forest to do that. But beyond that, everybody, whether you care about the environment or not, everybody should be insulted. Now, why should you be insulted? Because they're spending the money on billboards, bumper stickers, and yard signs on the basis that you'll vote because you've seen their name. Not because you know anything of any substance, but because of name recognition alone. I mean, what information does a billboard or a bumper sticker give you? What information do you get from a yard sign? What they're trying to do is imprint the image of the name so that when you go in to vote, if you have no other way of voting, no other thought process, haven't given it any more thought than that, you're going to put your liberty on the line because you saw somebody's name on a billboard, a bumper sticker, or a yard sign. That may be the biggest insult we see in party politics. You know, it's kind of funny, too. You've got these yard signs and billboards and bumper stickers, and you can't divert your eyes. You're forced to see them. Isn't it funny that you can be forced to see that? Nobody has a problem with it. But if you see a cross, wow, that can really be disruptive to your life. It's insane. And we've got to start fixing this problem. We've got to put some rational thought back into our political process. Now, let's talk a little bit about the selling of the soul that goes with party politics. Because there is, in my opinion, a little bit of a selling of a soul in the way it has evolved. Because it's so power-driven and so money-driven that I don't know how else to term it. If you're a party candidate, you're the successful Democratic Party candidate for president, or you're the successful Republican Party candidate for president, the first thing that happens is you are restricted by the party platform. The party creates this platform that most people haven't read. I've actually only found three people in the last 2 years who have ever read either of the platforms, other than people that have ultimately bought my books. So you have people who are driven by the black and white that appears in there. Now, sometimes they'll drift a little bit, but for the most part, they stay within the context of that party platform, which is why you see the incredible impasse on the Hill today, where one side won't consider any new form of revenue, regardless of whether it makes sense or not, and the other side won't consider any fiscal responsibility at all. Oh, we can't cut debt. That'll cut a vital program. You know, like the programs that we finance for China, after borrowing their money, paying interest on it, and then we spend $1 billion or $2 billion a year sending money back to them for research programs. Tell me that makes any sense. But the party candidates have to follow the party line. Let me tell you what happens. I'll tell you a little dirty secret that happens in the White House. President starts his or her morning getting up. The valet has the clothes laid out. They dress appropriately. They go to breakfast. Then they meet with their strategists. And their strategists tell them what the issue of the day is. They're given their agenda. They're told what they're going to do and what they're going to speak to. They're also told who within the context of their party is going to be speaking to the issue with the media and what their talking points are. That's a little frightening. That's the leader of the free world being told what's going to transpire, who's going to deliver the message, and those lemmings are being told exactly what to say by political strategists who decipher the data that they're given from polls and then give that structure to professional writers who craft the words. So we have leaders who are readers. There's a big difference. That's where a letter makes all the difference in the world. If you're reading what you're told to say versus you're expressing what you know, there's a difference between a reader and a leader. You also, when you're committed as a party candidate, you have to make a lot of unnecessary party appearances. You have to fly around the country. In the case of the president, Air Force One cost about $181,000 an hour to operate. Now, let's not get into how much it cost for Secret Service and the preparation of the city to which that president is flying. Let's not talk about the five-star hotels that they tend to stay in. Let's not talk about the three floors at a minimum that get booked because you have to have a floor above and below the president for security, as well as booking the entire floor that the president is on, again, for security reasons. Massive amount of money. Guess whose money that is? That's taxpayer money. But we can't cut programs. We can't cut the deficit. We're at $15 trillion and climbing. We've got to draw the line. And speaking of unnecessary appearances, when you're a member of a party, one of the most distasteful things that I find is when, particularly at the level of a president, where the president has to fly across the country and campaign on behalf of other party candidates. Now, he does that to be a good person for the party, to play the party line, but think about that. First of all, why would you ever vote for a candidate whose credibility was dependent on a person that he probably met 5 minutes before and may never meet again? Here's another inside tip. The president flies across the country because the president attracts a larger crowd. That means the president potentially attracts a larger voting base for that candidate and, very importantly, attracts more money, more donations. But the reality is, half the time, they've probably just met before they appear on stage together. So we won't even get into how demeaning it must be for the president of the United States to have to pretend that they're lifelong friends and that this is a great candidate and they know what they stand for and that the president is behind them. But that's a waste of time and it's a waste of money. They also participate in fundraising events. Another waste of taxpayer time and taxpayer money. There shouldn't be a minute of time or a penny of money spent on political campaign activities. We can't afford that now. Maybe we could afford that when we weren't at $15 trillion in debt. You know, frankly, I don't think we could have afforded when we were at $9 trillion in debt when the president took over. We certainly can't afford it at $15 trillion. The other problem when you're a party candidate, you have to repay favors. See, you become a party candidate because you've bought into the belief that you need money to be able to be elected. More money than ideas. And you need infrastructure. You need to have offices in every state and every city. You need to have solicitors on telephones, and you need to be doing email blast every minute of the day, trying to drive more and more and more money so that you can buy votes. Well, at the end of the day, you have to cash that check. You have to cash it for somebody else, the people who write the big checks. So, not to pick on the current president, but just to give you a level set, I happen to know the figures, the approximate figures for the current White House, but they probably haven't been far off during the Bush administration or the Clinton administration before that and so forth. But the current administration, about 80% of the senior White House appointments went to bundlers. Bundlers are people who circumvent the $5,000 individual limit by bundling other people who can generate big donations up to $5,000 to stay within the legal limit of the FEC. Now, the 80% of the bundlers that got senior White House staff positions raised $500,000 or more. Now, the White House has dismissed that, and Press Secretary Carney has dismissed that as just, well, you know, they're entitled to be eligible for those jobs, too. We have 310 million people in the United States. But 80% of those staff positions just coincidentally went to people, must have been really highly or uniquely qualified, that raised $500,000 or more. Almost 50% of the ambassadorships, the people that represent our countries in foreign countries, almost 50% of the ambassadorships went to bundlers who raised $500,000 or more. When are we going to get a candidate who bases appointments on merit? What would happen if we had a full-time president? Think about that from your private sector experience. If you had a part-time CEO, because the rest of the time they were out fundraising and going to events and putting their arm around other CEOs to say, hey, I endorse this CEO. It's a good analogy to what's going on in the political world. How do you think that company would fare as compared to a company with a full-time CEO? It would almost be unfair. What if we were to have a president who served as a full-time president. You know, I did turnarounds for 30 years. Business issues were always easy. If you could read a balance sheet, an income statement, and understand cash flow, you could identify the business problems fairly quickly and start targeting those. The real issues were behavioral. That was the key, because you had people who had learned to accept failure. They thought the products and services failed. They thought the expectations that were set by their leadership team had failed to be met, and they began to look at themselves as failures, and they began to accept failure. And I found there was a commonality in those companies. They were companies that had at one point in time created a vision and mission statement along with a value statement, and they cast them in bronze, put them up on a wall, and they got dusted maybe once a month by the janitorial staff, but they were never looked at again. It was just an exercise that every company has to go through. The companies that weren't failing assiduously stayed in line with their vision, their mission, and their values. They made every critical decision. Is this in alignment with our vision, our mission, and our values? And one of the great benefits we have in this country is that we have a great value statement in the Declaration of Independence. And we have a vision and mission laid out with a reasonably high degree of clarity in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, along with the additional amendments. It's time we got back to those founding documents. It's time we understood our civics. It's time that we put money behind the importance of liberty. Don't go away. We'll be right back in a minute with some final comments. This is T.J. O'Hara filling in for Rick Amato tonight. You know, this is all about personal philosophy. I had a mentor years ago at a company that we took to Fortune 500 status. He only said this once, but it never left me. You need to fix the problem, not the blame. What a blessing that would be in American politics today. There's another quote by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Treat people as if they were what they ought to be, and you will help them become what they are capable of becoming. If we didn't spend so much time fixing the blame, and instead we focused on the facts, identifying the problems, identifying the alternatives, and evaluating them, and picking the best one, regardless of which party authored it, or if a third party authored it, we would be far better off. And I want to share a final story with you. It's called The Story of Two Wolves. I used to tell this at Indian Guides when my son was growing up. It's one evening, an old Cherokee told his grandson about a battle that goes on inside people. He said, "My son, the battle is between two wolves inside us all. One is evil. It is anger, envy, jealousy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego. The other is good. It is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith." The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, "Which wolf wins?" The old Cherokee simply replied, "The one you feed." It's time to stop feeding the wrong wolf, America. We don't have to accept party politics as usual. We need to vet the candidates, ask the questions, demand the right answers, and make them make the right decisions. That's our hope going forward. And as we wrap up the show, I want to thank Todd, particularly for that insert from Network News. That was spur of the moment. I hadn't told him about that ahead of time, so I'm really impressed, Todd. Thank you so much for your help, as always. And I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for thinking. I want to thank you for taking your responsibility as a voter seriously. This is T.J. O'Hara, and I approve of this message. Good night, America.
You've been listening to the award-winning Rick Amato.